Thank you for listening to an audio recording from the Midwest Genealogy Center's Tell Me a Story program, an initiative dedicated to preserving America's history through the timeless practice of oral storytelling. To learn more about the Tell Me a Story program, including how you can add your own story to the collection, visit MidwestGenealogyCenter.org/tellmeastory. On behalf of the Midwest Genealogy Center and Mid-Continent Public Library, we hope you enjoy the following story.
Good morning. Today is Wednesday, February the 19th, 2020. I'm doing an interview today with veteran Randy Scott, who is with the United States Marine Corps. Good morning, Randy.
Good morning, Marie.
Can you give me your full name?
Randy Lee Scott.
And you were in the United States Marines.
I was.
What was your enlisted date and what was the date that you were discharged?
I went in 1969 and discharged in 1975.
And what was your rank in the United States Marines?
Sergeant E5.
Okay. Do you want to start with your military history, Randy?
Sure.
Would that be okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Most veterans that I have interviewed to date have been influenced by a person or an event. Can you give me a little background on why you decided to join the United States Marines, and when did that happen? How old were you?
Actually, it was in 1969 during our career day there at Northeast High School. Two things that I always knew that I wanted to do was be a Marine and be a police officer. And so both of those people were there for career day in our senior year, because we both went to high school together.
Yes.
And so the Marine and the police officer both influenced me to say, hey, that's what I want to do.
So the rest, as they say, is part of the history that we're going to go through today.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Where were you born? Can you tell me a little bit about what the city was that you were born in, the name of your parents, and if you have siblings, what were their names?
Yes, I was born in Kansas City, Missouri, and I have four sisters. And we were all brought up in the Kansas City area, born on the west side of Kansas City, and then years later we moved to the Northeast District and grew up in the Northeast District.
So you were a only child male in a family of four sisters.
Yes.
Were you the youngest?
I was the oldest.
Oh, you were the oldest.
Yes.
Oh, wow, big brother.
Yes.
And what were your sisters' names, Randy?
Linda, Bonnie, Connie, and Cheryl.
Okay. And your parents' full names, your mother's maiden name?
My mother's maiden name was Carol Sue Orr, O-R-R.
And your father's name?
My father's name was Ewell, E-U-E-L-L. Middle name was Willard, last name Scott.
And was your father a military person as well?
He was. He was in the Army. He was a paratrooper during World War II and served at the Black Forest in Germany as a paratrooper. I tried to look up some information. Unfortunately, his records were part of the ones that were burned in the fire in the archives there in St. Louis.
I remember reading about that.
Yeah.
Yes. Did your father share any stories with you about his military service?
Very few. He was definitely your, I guess, typical World War II veteran that didn't like talking about things too much. One of the things that I do remember, he used to talk about when he was in Germany, after they marched all day long, their feet would sweat really bad. And then at nighttime, when it got really super cold, a lot of men suffered from frostbite on their feet.
Yeah, that's not a story that you want to remember.
Right.
For sure, definitely. Well, let's talk a little bit about your growing up. You said on the west side, mm-hmm. that you were born in Kansas City and you grew up on the west side with your four younger sisters. Are there any events growing up that influenced you in as much as that you wanted to join the service and you wanted to be a police officer? Was there anything there that you think back now that that seed was planted long before career day at your senior year?
No, not really. I think, you know, I always had an influential desire of the military when I was young. There was always something about people that were in the military that really struck me kind of cool, I guess. And I know that military people, even back then, They were the kind of people that I thought I always wanted to be, because they seemed to be the kind of people that were always there to help somebody. And I think that influenced me. I like that first responder. I like that helping people type of thing.
Mm-hmm. I from knowing you from our history back to high school, that, you know, we went to high school, I understand that, because I remember it in high school.
Right.
You were always there for me. If I wanted an ear to share whatever my feelings or emotions were, you were there.
Yeah, we did share a lot together.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. Let's go back and talk a little bit about your parents. Your mother and father, you grew up on the west side of Kansas City. Did your parents' livelihood, obviously your father's military service, was before he was married, or was he married at the time to your mother?
Before he was married.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So when he came out of the service, was he able to use those skills that he was able to support his family?
Actually, Dad had a kind of a funny, I guess you would say, lifestyle. Mm-hmm. After he came out of the military, he was a carny when he came out of the Army. He actually joined a carnival, a traveling carnival, and worked on a carnival. And that's where my mom met him, was at a carnival in Kansas City that used to come behind the old cat store on Independence Avenue.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And my dad was considerably older than my mom. He was born in 1921. And she was born in 1936. And so mom met him at the carnival, but he traveled with the carnival for a while. And then he finally settled down and went to work for a company called Sinclair Valentine, which made printing ink there in North Kansas City.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of interesting. That's not a story I think I ever remember asking you about your father. So he was with the carnival, and he traveled to Kansas City. So that's why he made Kansas City his home, because that's where your mother was from.
Yes, Dad and my dad actually was born and raised in St. Joe, Missouri.
Okay, so it wasn't that far away,
right,
his family.
Right.
Well, since we're talking about family, what do you remember of your grandparents, your father's parents, and what do you remember of your mother's parents?
My father's parents, I don't recall a whole lot about them. They lived in St. Joe, Missouri, and we never really had a good connection with his parents. Now, my great-grandfather, who was my dad's grandfather, we had a very good relationship with him. Actually, his name was James Randolph Scott, and so they named me Randy after his middle name. But, of course, they didn't name me Randolph. They just went with Randy. And he was a very interesting man. He worked for the St. Joe Railroad for 45 years and only missed 3 days of work. And he was a wrecking foreman for the railroad. And so we would go up to St. Joe on Sundays and have family dinner. And he would sit in a rocking chair and tell us old train stories from the 1800s. And very nice man. I love that man to death. He had snow white hair and a big snow white mustache. And he always wore a little vest all the time. And had that railroad pocket watch, but he would tell us train stories for hours. And of course, back in the 1800s, that was very interesting.
Yeah, because trains were very prevalent
during
that period.
They were, yes.
Mm-hmm. And your grandfather's name was James Randolph?
My great-grandfather.
Grandfather was James mm-hmm. Randolph.
My grandfather, I don't recall. Now, the grandmother's name was Gertrude. Harold was his name, Harold Scott, and Gertrude was her name. And again, we just didn't have a very close relationship with them.
But your mother's parents were living, and they were in Kansas City, and you had a closer relationship with them.
We did.
And Ira, what was their names?
Uh-huh. Ira Orr was my grandfather, and Bessie Orr was my grandmother. Very old style names.
Yes, very bad. definitely. Do you have some stories you'd like to share in as much as with your mother's parents growing up?
Well, Grandpa, he was a very tall, 6'4" gentleman, had a deep voice, kind of like the rest of the male side of our family. He was a house painter, was his career. And my grandmother, Bessie, she worked as a cashier for the Salvation Army there in Kansas City for 20-something years, and would go from different stores every day of the week. She was kind of a relief lady at the different stores and worked at the Salvation Army. And that's actually where me and my sisters got all of our clothes and shoes, because with five kids back in those days, my mom didn't work. So, I can remember my grandma would take a newspaper and draw the outside of our feet. And then when she went to the stores, she would try to find shoes for us that fit our feet. And that's the clothes and shoes that we got was from Salvation Army.
Uh-huh. That's a good story. She's looking after you, definitely. Okay, I'd like to go back a little bit and talk a little bit about your military time that you spent. You had told me what influenced you was senior day, or career day at high school, your senior year, the military and the police officer. I know that you served in the United States Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. During that period, how long a period were you in the Marine Corps? Were you in there 4 years, 5 years?
6.5 years.
6.5 years. Mm-hmm. And during that time, you started out in boot camp, obviously.
Right.
Where did you start out your boot camp? Where were you stationed?
San Diego, California.
And you spent 12 weeks, 16 weeks?
Back in those days, it was 8 weeks because the Vietnam War was still going on. So they had a short period of basic training because they wanted to get people out and get them moving into the Vietnam era. And so I had 8 weeks of basic training. And then we had another 2 weeks of what they called ITR, which was Infantry Training Regiment. And then another couple of weeks of Basic Infantry Training Regiment. And then from there, you would go home on leave and then go back to California to what they call Staging Battalion. And during that time is when they would send you through what they would call Ho Chi Minh City. And it was a city that was kind of built up there in the Camp Pendleton, California, to give you an idea of what it was going to be like in Vietnam. They had hidden booby traps, hidden doors, things like that, to try to get you ready to go into that sort of situation. What happened was, when I went back to California for that training, I was only there 2 days. And at that time, the 1st Marine Division was being pulled back to Okinawa. And so my orders for Vietnam had got canceled. So they called us all out one day and said, okay, everybody is going to go to a different location because the 1st Marine Division is being pulled back to Okinawa. The Vietnam War is coming to an end. So I got sent to Parris Island, South Carolina, and they made me a rifle instructor for recruits.
And how long did that...
That lasted, I was there about 8 months, and then I was at the company headquarters one day, and I was just sitting there, and this lieutenant colonel walked up to me and said, how would you like to go to Bermuda? I don't think I remember where Bermuda was at that time. And I said, okay. And he said, well, the Navy is taking over an Air Force base in Bermuda, and we need Marines to go there for security purposes, because at that time, that was in the 70s, the Navy was still doing secret underwater nuclear stuff because the Cold War was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Bermuda for 2 years, which was nice.
Well, good.
So I did 2 years in Bermuda. And then I left, and they put me right back at Parris Island, South Carolina. And
you were back to the training to the...
No, that was the funny thing was when I reported in, there was a gunnery sergeant, which is an E-7. He said, hey, you're from Kansas City. And I said, yeah. He goes, I'm from Independence. And I said, oh, really? And he says... I see you were in Bermuda for 2 years. And I said, yeah. He goes, wow, that's quite a spit and polish outfit, because there were a lot of dignitaries that came to Bermuda, a lot of generals and secretaries of state and what have you, because it was a big golf community and one thing and another. And so we had to do all the escorts and protection and what have you. So I said, yeah, you know, it really was. He says, well, I think you need a break. So he said, we're going to put you working in the officers club. I'm like, okay. So he sends me down to the officers club and I report into this major. And he goes, what am I supposed to do with you? I'm like, I don't know. They sent me here. So I became a food storage person. I didn't know anything about food storage, you know. So I worked there for a while, about 9 months, and then I reenlisted. And they sent me to Whidbey Island, Washington, at a naval station there, and I worked Marine Security. That was Naval Air Station that had a what they called a secret security office. And that secret security office received crypto messages from Vietnam. And so there were a lot of secret messages coming into this security office.
Did you have to have a background check? Or
I did. I had to have a secret clearance and a reliability background check.
Okay.
And before I could even go to, even to Bermuda and then to Whidbey Island, Washington.
Okay.
Because they also had spy planes at that Naval Air Station in Whidbey Island.
Wow. So how long did that last?
That lasted about a year and a half. And then the lieutenant called me down one day and said, pack your sea bag. You're going overseas. And off to Okinawa I went. And at that time, I was married, had a son, and then had another child on the way. So they delayed my orders for a couple of months until my second child was born. And then they shipped me off to Okinawa. And so get to Okinawa, I'm only there about 2 weeks, and they said, well, we're going to put you on a float. So they put me on the USS Okinawa.
What's a float?
A float is where you go out on a ship, and so they call it a float, and they put you like on a aircraft carrier, helicopter carrier, something like that.
But they refer to it as a float.
Yes, they do.
Okay.
And so they put me on the USS Okinawa, and funny story there. No more than we had left Okinawa, we had a typhoon for 3 days. Never been so sick in my entire life. I mean, that ship, those waves took that ship like it was a toy and went from one side to the other, and then swells just as high as they could, would come over the top of the ship, which was a helicopter carrier. And I crawled on the floor for 3 days and didn't eat. I couldn't do anything. And then we finally came into Hong Kong. And after we got into Hong Kong, everything had settled down from the typhoon. And so I spent Christmas in Hong Kong and was only there a couple of weeks. And of course, that kind of makes you homesick, you know, mm-hmm. being Christmas and everything. So from there, we went to the Philippines and we offloaded everything off the ship, all the cargo and things that we needed. We hadn't been there 2 days, and they called us back from playing war games. We actually played war games on a famous island called Tinian, which was a big combat zone during World War II, the island of Tinian. And we were there playing war games, and they called us back and made us unload everything back on the ship. And they said they wouldn't tell us where we were going. So we took off and nobody knew anything. We just started going. So we were steaming along pretty quick. And next thing I know, we were off the coast of South Vietnam. And so they finally told us that we were going to have to go into the American Embassy as an evacuation because the North Vietnamese were getting ready to overrun Saigon. And the South Vietnamese were trying to overrun the embassy to take our helicopters and what have you. And a lot of people have seen that on television where the refugees and all kinds of people were trying to overrun the American Embassy. So we went around in circles for like 45 days waiting to go in. And Do you want me to tell you the funny stories?
Yes.
Okay. There's a couple of funny stories, actually. We couldn't get resupplied out there when we were setting off the coast of South Vietnam because there were several times we would have enemy aircraft and we would have to go to general quarters. So the supply ships couldn't come in. So for like 30 days, the only two movies that were on ship were Enter the Dragon with Bruce and Walking Tall with Joe Don Baker. So every night it was either Enter the Dragon with Bruce Lee or Walking Tall with Joe Don Baker.
So you know those two movies very well.
Yeah. So at the end of the 30 days, everybody was either a kung fu expert or they wanted to be a sheriff somewhere, you know. So, you know, that kind of went on. And, of course, the food started, you know, getting down to practically nothing. We were having to take limited showers because we didn't have fresh water. Mm-hmm. And the Okinawa was such an old ship, the showers were old metal showers, and they had like tons of fungus on it. So everybody was getting ringworm on their feet and prickly heat and so on and so forth. So those were the kind of things that you kind of remember a little bit about.
Right.
And then finally, one morning, about 4 o'clock in the morning, all the lights came on, and they sounded general quarters. And we knew then that we were probably going to go into Vietnam. So we all got up, got all of our gear, got all of our weapons, and that sort of thing. And so we were waiting and waiting and waiting. Nothing happened. So after a couple of hours, they said, okay, you can secure from general quarters. Well, that went on for a week. Up at 4 o'clock in the morning, getting all of our gear. Well, what they were doing, they were building us up psychologically. By the end of that week, we were like, send us in right now because we're ready to do whatever we need to do because I'm tired of this psychological getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Never even thought about it that way.
Yeah, but they knew what they were doing. Sure. You know, the military knows what they're doing. Yeah, they've been through it a number of years. So, but if I can go back a little bit, when we were steaming towards Vietnam, one day they said, okay, we're going to have target practice. So we went out onto the fantail of the ship, which is the back of the ship. Mm-hmm. And so the Navy had thrown out 55-gallon drum barrels out in the water for us to shoot at. And so we were shooting off the fantail and shooting at the barrel. And, of course, typical Marines, we'd shoot it up and laugh and have a good time and one thing and another. Well, I carried an M79 grenade launcher and a 45 handgun. Yeah, the M79 is a high explosive that lobs out and explodes. So I'm back there and I'm shooting these high explosive rounds and the water is going everywhere and we're all laughing. What a good time this is. Suddenly the Navy guy goes, cease fire, cease fire. He tells our captain, the Marine captain, he said, sir, the captain of the ship, which is a Navy man, wants to see you right away. Well, what they forgot before they had us go out there to tell the captain of the ship, there were submarines that were protecting us, and they were hearing those high explosive rounds going off in the water. I'm sure the sonar guy's thinking, what in the heck's going on? So our captain got a little chewed out over that, but it was fun. It was a good time.
So, okay, so for 45 days, you're going around and around and around.
Yeah.
And they're doing this drill constantly for 5 days to get you ready. You finally are ready, and you're going out.
Right.
Tell me about that day.
It was raining a little bit when we landed, and we landed right next to the attaché building of the embassy. And I was a squad leader. I was with the 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, Fox Company, 1st Squad, 1st Squad Leader. And so as the senior sergeant, my job was I was on the first wave of helicopters in. I was the first one off the helicopter, And the theory was that I would draw enemy fire. I was the guinea pig to find out where the enemy was, if there was any. Mm-hmm. So I ran out so far, and then I would give the all clear sign. Well, everybody would come running off the helicopter. So there was a group of three helicopters at the beginning. So we all get off the helicopters. Well, we start setting up our perimeter, which was behind a electrified fence that they had built around the embassy and the attaché building. And they also had a gasoline molt outside of the fence line. And then they had concrete water whistles. If we had to, we could get inside those whistles. If we were getting too much rocket or motor fire, we could get in there for protection.
So it was like a canal, when you say whistle, that you could lay in there.
Yes.
With your body. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so we get in, and there was quite a bit going on. Of course, the city of Saigon, the people were in a complete panic. Mm-hmm. People were running around in all different directions. People were committing suicide on the streets. People would come up to the fence. They were offering us pieces of gold. Women were offering to be sex slaves if we would get them on a helicopter and get them out. And of course, we couldn't do that. And when we went up for our intelligence report, they told us, be careful, because the South Vietnamese people are so desperate to get out, they may try to overrun us and take our helicopters away from us. So we had the North Vietnamese that were right at the city limits of Saigon. And then we had the South Vietnamese people who were in such a panic that they were willing to do anything to get out. I actually seen a woman carry a young child that had a bullet wound in the leg. And my captain spoke Vietnamese because he had been there a couple of times already. And she was talking to him through the fence. And so he said, I want you to get a couple of your guys and have them climb the fence, get this child. We're going to medevac the child out because he had a bullet wound. So I had two Marines climb the top of the fence and get this child from this elderly woman. And after she had given us the child, she walked across the street and pulled out a gun and shot herself in the head. The only thing she was concerned about was getting the child out. Mm-hmm. And she knew it was going to be bad after that, so she just killed herself.
Mm. So you're moving on. You're still there. You're still there. In charge.
The helicopters are coming in every 10 minutes. Cobra helicopters coming in, and the evacuation helicopters are coming in every 10 minutes intervals. And they're evacuating people just left and right.
Are they landing on the roof of the embassy?
They're on the embassy and actually on the ground where we were at it by the attaché building, which is very close to Tonsonut Airport. And a lot of people remember Tonsonut Airport during that time. There was a big article about the things that went on there.
Was this event called a specific event that happened that day?
Yes, that was called Operation Eagle, Operation Frequent Wind, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Eagle Pull was the one that I was involved in Cambodia, so we'll talk about that a little later.
Okay.
But yeah, Operation Frequent Wind is the operation that it was called.
Okay.
And so that as that went on, there were some times that were very disturbing. I got a little nervous. We started receiving some rocket fire, and we didn't know if it was from the North Vietnamese or if it was South Vietnamese sympathizers. Mm-hmm. And we started receiving small arms fire. And then the Marine Cobra helicopters would fly over the rooftops, and all of a sudden there's no more shooting going on. So they did their job protecting us.
Right.
We had an old First Sergeant Jordan, I never forget his name. Guy was the toughest Marine I've ever seen before. He was a Swedish guy, had a big rock jaw that came out, and he'd been in the Marine Corps over 30 years already, and the man had ribbons that went up over his shoulder and came over the other side, and he had shoulders about that wide, and he was the toughest man I'd ever seen before, and he was there with us. And so after we were there for a while, he grabs a a lower enlisted man, and they went down to where the Jeeps and stuff were, steals a Jeep, breaks, of course we're leaving anyway, so he doesn't care, and he's a tough old guy. So he steals this Jeep out of the motor pool, goes down to a warehouse, loads up a bunch of beer and pop, and he's driving the Jeep, and he's got this lower enlisted guy throwing pop and beer to the guys out in the field.
It's up.
Yeah. And the shooting starts, and he's looking up in the sky because the rockets were coming in a little bit, and he's giving them a hand gesture, and he's like, "You can't kill me, you know. I mean, the guy's got 2 silver stars and 4 or 5 purple hearts. I mean, he's just an old Marine, and I mean, he was just tough as that could be." And so that was kind of a funny story.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And then one time I had to get into a window trying to get some water, and my cartridge belt got stuck on the windowsill. And I'm trying to get into this bathroom to fill canteens up with water because, you know, it's pretty hot there in the Vietnam area. And there was already a guy in the bathroom, and I was tossing him the canteens, and all of a sudden we start receiving sniper fire, and I can hear it hitting the wall. And I tell this guy, I'm like, "Come get me, pull me." He said, "I ain't coming over there." So my rear end's sticking out of this window, and I'm thinking I'm going to get shot in the butt, and I'm going to get a purple heart for getting shot in the butt, you know. So
talk about your behind in the wind.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So from there, everything went fairly smooth.
How long did this event take place? Over a week, a month?
No, it was a one-day event. One day. Yeah, except for the 45 days that we went around in circles.
One day you did all of that.
Yeah, yeah. They say that that evacuation was the biggest evacuation since Dunkirk.
I remember the story, but I don't remember, you know, how long that event lasted.
Yeah.
How many people were evacuated from that building did you take out that day?
Oh.
Several hundred?
Thousands.
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 Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, thousands.
That is a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, those Marine helicopters were doing 10-minute intervals. One of the things that always disturbed me was that I almost had to shoot one of my own men because he was being a coward in the face of the enemy. And I think that's why I probably have PTSD sometimes. He was a young man that I thought was going to be an excellent Marine. And when we landed, I was going around positioning my Marines, and I couldn't find him. And I asked somebody, I said, where's Oliphant? They're like, "I don't know, but there's his rifle. His rifle is laying there on the ground. He was in one of those culverts hiding." So I went over and I dragged him out. And I'm like, "You know, what are you doing?" And he said, I'm scared. I said, "We're all scared, you know." And it just really shocked me because he'd been a top Marine the whole time on the way over there. So I said, "You know, here's your rifle. This is your field of fire." In other words, you know, he had a certain area. They all have certain areas that they cover. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Here's your field of fire. Don't leave your position." So I go around, I'm checking my people, make sure nobody's hurt, what have you. I come back, he's gone. He's back in this culvert again. Well, now I'm mad and I'm scared. So I get him out and I take him over to an area and I get him down on his knees. And everybody will have to forgive me for this. But I pulled out my .45 and I put it up to his head and I said, "You're either going to be involved in this or I'm going to shoot you myself." Now, they would have court-martialed me if I'd have shot him. But I wanted him to know how serious things were. So I told him, I said, "I want you to run out to this one area, take out your little entrenching tool, which is a little shovel, dig a hole, and that's going to be where you're going to be." So he runs out. The ground was so hard he couldn't dig a hole. all of a sudden we start catching sniper fire. Well, there was a burned out Jeep laying there that had gotten a mortar round earlier before we got there. I'm like, get behind the Jeep before you get killed, you know? And so he runs behind the Jeep. And when it was over with, I told him, I said, I ought to have you court-martialed for being a coward in the face of the enemy. And I didn't. I didn't follow through with it. I felt bad for the kid. Mm-hmm. You know, I was scared. He was scared. You know, I thought I was going to shoot him myself. I knew what would have happened to me if I had of, but it all came out okay.
That's good. I'm glad that it did.
Yeah, me too.
Yes.
And so they ended up moving us to a different location because we were catching so much sniper fire that the what they call the LZ, the landing zone, was getting too hot for the helicopters to land. And when we had our intelligence before going in, they told us if the LZ got too hot, here would be the next LZ, so we had to move our people to a different location.
Can you clarify what too hot means for the listener to this interview?
Too hot means that you're catching so much enemy fire, the helicopters aren't able to land without somebody getting hurt. You know, if the rockets or the mortar rounds are getting close, there's always that chance that they're going to hit the helicopters, and of course, people are going to start dying. So we had to move everybody about a block down the street from the embassy.
Okay. And this event took place all in a day?
All in a day.
Wow. Have you ever written a book or sat down and journaled all this,
Andy? I have not, but I've actually had several people tell me that I should.
You should. I think you should. I think now is especially the time. I realize from hearing stories from my own veteran that Vietnam is now being realized that our boys that went over there were not recognized when they came home, and now here it is 50 years later, they're being recognized. So I think while the interest is there, I think it would be something that would be well received if you haven't thought about it, you know, that you could do that.
Yeah, thank you, Murray. You know, you're not the first one to tell me that. I've thought about it. Sometimes I've even sat down and wrote down some things, thinking I should at least jog down some memories, you know, of what went on.
Okay. Is there another event that happened that when you were in Vietnam?
Not in Vietnam. Oh, I'm sorry. I take that back. I was on the last three helicopters out. And so as we were leaving, you know, I one of my jobs was I took what they call a manifest ticket from my people in my squad. Ticket had their name and their rank and their serial number. So, and then I put all of their information in my flak jacket. So if the helicopter gets shot down, they know to go to the sergeant, look in his pocket. It will have everybody's name and what have you on there.
Did not know that.
Yeah. So, you know, I counted all my people, got their manifest tickets, put it in my flak jacket, and off we go. So we're flying along, and of course, you know, you're kind of taking a deep breath like, okay, we got out of here, you know. So we fly along in the helicopter for a while, and all of a sudden the helicopter starts shaking, and it's coming straight down, and it's shaking, and I'm thinking, oh, we got shot down. And all it was they were landing on the ship. Well, they didn't take us back to the Okinawa because it was already full of evacuees. So they moved us to a different ship called the Duluth, and it only had one little helicopter pad. So the pilot had to come straight down out of the sky, and so those old helicopters was shaking, and of course they're so old, oil's dripping everywhere and everything. But I'm thinking, oh great, we got through this, and now we got shot down. We're gonna be POWs, you know. But we got on the Duluth, and they didn't have room for us in any of the bunks because it was a smaller ship. It was actually a transport carrier. It carried jeeps and that sort of thing. So all of my people had to sleep down where the jeeps were and all the diesel fuel, and we had to find a place to sleep because all of the bunks were taken up by the Navy guys. So we slept, you know, typical Marines. Yeah, okay, we've done this before, you know. So we slept there and down below. And the next morning, we got up, and they're like, okay, we're going to move you back to the Okinawa. We go out, And like I said, the USS Duluth only had the one helicopter pad, so it was one helicopter at a time. We're all standing there, and I can remember the sky was the bluest sky I'd ever seen before. It was just a perfect day. And as we walk out to the flight deck, all of a sudden, it was like a swarm of locusts. The sky was full of black things. It was the South Vietnamese making that last-ditch effort to get out of Vietnam. And all of their helicopter pilots and their helicopters were trying to get out. And they just filled up the sky with black helicopters. And they were crashing into the water. They were landing one helicopter on top of another. The Navy, they would land a helicopter on the helicopter pad on the Duluth, and the Navy was actually pushing their helicopters off the edge of the ship. And there's a lot of the shows that show that, where the helicopter being pushed over. And some of them would hover over the water, and the pilot would jump out into the ocean. The Navy guys would send somebody out to get them. The Marines would do security and pat people down for hand grenades and weapons and that sort of thing. But that was a pretty much all-day event. And then, of course, there were a lot of people that suffered a lot of injuries because they jumped out of the helicopter, or one helicopter would land on top of another. A lot of people, South Vietnamese people, got killed from that pilot-wise. So that went on. So we didn't get back to our mothership that day. We had
to
wait till the next.
Can I clarify something there? Huh? While all this event is happening, you're on this Duluth watching this take place. Are you also, as Marines, rescuing the people that are in the water that are South Vietnamese?
Most of that was done by the Navy.
Okay.
Yeah, the Navy did most of that kind of work.
United States was taking those people out of the water
that needed to be rescued. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I want to make sure we understood what was actually happening.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The United States Navy was rescuing the people out of the ocean, and then the Marines were patting them down and doing security for weapons and what have you.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. And this took place all in a day.
All in a day.
It's turned out to be a sunny, clear day.
Yep.
And then the sky filled up.
Yep. Yep. It looked like locusts. I can always remember that. It just looked like black locusts came from everywhere.
Was anybody taking pictures of any of these events that, you know, you're talking about on the ship? I know that history has documented there's been some filmage that say that it was actually happened, or pictures that are actually happening. And I know from a nephew who's in the Navy that they actually had a person that was on the ship that was responsible for taking pictures. Do you recall any of these events?
I don't recall. I know the Navy has Navy journalists that do that sort of thing. The only journalist that I remember taking pictures or talking to was when we went into Cambodia to do that evacuation. I actually got interviewed by a newspaper person. I don't know who he worked for. I had other things on my mind. But as we were getting ready to leave from that evacuation, he wanted to know, you know, how'd things go, where am I from, and that sort of thing. And, you know, I answered a few simple questions, and it's like, hey, I'm kind of busy here.
Right. Well, what other event happened while you were in the service? You said that was one of two stories that you had told us about.
I was also involved in Operation Eagle Pool, which was the evacuation in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, where the ambassador and his people were evacuated. So we went back to the Philippines, offloaded everybody, thought we were going to be on liberty for a while, and they made us get back on the ship again and took off, and they wouldn't tell us where we were going, and we went into Cambodia and evacuated the ambassador and his people in Phnom Penh. That was pretty interesting. We actually landed on a soccer field, and they had the ambassador and his people in a hidden underground parking lot of a soccer field next to an apartment complex. And so we get off, and again, I'm with 2nd Battalion, 4th Marines, Fox Company. and we surround the soccer field. There were a lot of Cambodians that more like just wanted to see what was going on. They, you know, they saw the Marine helicopters.
They weren't a threat.
No, they weren't a threat. They just kind of wanted to look. And it was our job just to kind of keep them back and, you know, so they wouldn't interfere with anything. We thought everything was fine, you know. So we were there about, if I recall, about an hour and a half, because there wasn't near as many people evacuating from there. And so we get done, and everything had gone very smooth. And I get my people lined up, and I'm getting their manifest tickets. And this reporter comes along, says a few things, asks me a few questions. And so the last three helicopters land in this soccer field, and there were a lot of people at this apartment complex standing on the porches watching us. Mm-hmm. And as we start walking towards our helicopters, the apartment complexes get hit by mortar rounds. So the Cambodians had zeroed in and were trying to locate us because they wanted to kill us.
Uh-huh.
And so people at the apartment complex, there were people killed, Cambodians, people, civilians killed by these mortar rounds. And so the lieutenant, he's like, okay, stop. And so we stood there for a few minutes, and I said, Lieutenant, we got to get going because they're zeroing in is what they're trying to do. They're trying to find our location to zero in on us. So he said, okay, let's double time to the helicopters. So we take off running. We get in the helicopters. Helicopters get up, and I'm looking at the back of the helicopter because I'm the last one to get on. And just as the helicopters are pulling away, the mortar rounds start hitting right where the helicopters were. And so if you look up that particular operation, it'll talk about that, about the mortar rounds hitting the area.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we have several more minutes.
Okay.
And one of the things that I'd like to ask you about is, what would you like to be most remembered for?
That I just did a job. I love the Marine Corps. I really did. And I just want to be remembered as just a Marine that was told to do his job. You know, as you and I both know, the 60s were a very rocky time.
Yes.
You know, civil unrest. Nobody wanted the Vietnam War to go on. You know, I can tell you stories about, because when I traveled from one duty station to another, I had to travel in uniform because we went military standby. Tell you stories about not being served in restaurants because I was, you know, in uniform and nobody would serve me food, getting called baby killer and spit on and all the things that go along with it that you hear about. Of course, you know, the big hippie generation thing was going on, and so you had all that going on as well as the war itself. But I think I just want to be remembered as just a man from Kansas City that went to the Marines on his own, volunteered, and I did the best job that I could.
And thank you for your service.
You're very welcome, Marie.
One last question.
Sure.
As soon as I find it. What do you believe is the most important lesson that you've learned in life?
That life's not always fair. That there's going to be ups and downs. There's going to be good times and bad times. And I'm a true believer that you have to believe in your friends. You have to believe in your church congregation. You have to believe in God. Because I know that I talked to God a lot when I was in those situations.
I can only imagine.
And, you know, people just have to learn to get along. Everybody's got a job to do, and we do what we do. And I was a proud Marine, and I was a proud police officer, and I would do it all over again if my country asked me to do it.
And I truly believe that. And I know that we didn't get to touch on it much, but I know that you did fulfill your I guess I would call it a destiny, because you said there was two things you wanted to do in life, was to be a Marine and to be a police officer. And I do know that you became a police officer. I don't remember the time period, but could you share a little bit about when you were a police officer and what city you were a police mm-hmm. officer?
I did law enforcement for 30 years after I got out of the Marine Corps. I traveled around from one place to another. When I got out in 1975, they weren't hiring former military like they were in the past. Mm-hmm. And so there was a big push to hire minorities and women and so on and so forth. And all that controversy was going on during mm-hmm. that time. So I kind of traveled around and worked for the Missouri State Water Patrol as a dispatcher. Worked in Benton County with the Benton County Sheriff's Department in Warsaw, Missouri. And then eventually went to Harrisonville Police Department for about a year and a half. And then I did 27 years with the Belton, Missouri Police Department. Worked the streets for 20 years. And then I was commander of the juvenile unit for 10 years and worked child abuse and child sex crimes.
That one was a tough.
That was tough. That turned my hair gray.
Yeah, that one did. Is there anything I haven't asked that you'd like to share in these last few minutes, Randy? Anything that I haven't?
Only that I appreciate you for what you're doing. And I appreciate you talking with me about all of this. And you've made it very easy for me to talk with you about all this. It's not an easy thing sometimes. But, you know, I just want my family to know that I love being a part of them. And again, I'd do it all over again for my country.
And I truly believe that, Randy.
Thank you.